Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. The first half of this hour, a continuation of open lines from the last hour, your questions and your comments. And then we'll be talking with Wesley Smith about the new PETA ad campaign. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., these questions. Is feeding the poor, is that evangelism? Is paving your parking lot in your church, is that evangelism? What about praying with an unbeliever? Is that evangelism? We'll have answers to those questions with Professor Kurt Marquardt tomorrow on Issues Etc. He's from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Also tomorrow on the program, the church's role in confession and forgiveness. Ted Kober will be our guest. He's author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, titled Confession and Forgiveness. It's open lines for your questions and your comments today on Issues Etc. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's go back to the phones. Jonathan's been waiting through the break. Jonathan, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to comment in regard to what was said before the break, that America needs to rectify, for example, abortion before it projects itself on Iraq.
Well, that's not what I said, but go ahead.
Well, anyway, I agree that abortion is wrong, but to demand moral perfection before someone can act, I think is a sort of false logic. In fact, it condemns someone not to act.
Well, you're absolutely right, Jonathan, because you're absolutely right. And let me clear up what I did say. I did not say that we shouldn't be going to Iraq. But in lieu of going to Iraq, we should be fighting abortion. We should be doing both, in my opinion, with full vigor. It's the same argument that is made when someone says, well, North Korea is a threat to, in argument that we shouldn't be going to Iraq. Just because you have three bad men who live in your neighborhood doesn't mean that you do nothing and sit around. Maybe you have to take them one at a time. Now, on the issue of abortion, what I'm arguing for is I think we're perfectly capable of dealing with the human rights violations that is abortion in the United States and going to a war with Iraq at the same time. We don't need the U.S. Army to do the first. They can be fully occupied in the second task. So, Jonathan, you're absolutely right. I am not arguing against a war with Iraq because there's abortion in America. We will always be able to find evils in the world and within our borders that could serve as excuses for not doing what we need to do abroad or within our borders. Someone could argue the opposite, too. I mean, it wouldn't be valid, but they could argue, look, we got to take care of Iraq before we worry about abortion. Who says? Maybe we should do both at the same time with equal vigor. I'm simply asking that we be equally concerned about both. And in particular, I think that our president and our lawmakers be equally concerned about both. How is it that we can get a Senate approval of, back in 2002, the Senate to approve military action against Iraq, 70-23, and we can't get that Senate to ban partial birth abortion? How is that? It's because they're not as concerned. Period. It's that simple. And by the same logic, of course, one might also argue, and it would be, and Jonathan is right in pointing out the logic is invalid, that all of the wrong things that the President Bill Clinton did somehow would make his action, if all other things were being equal, his action in Iraq, if he were president, unsupportable. No, just because he's wrong in other areas doesn't mean that waging war on Iraq would be wrong. Just because President Bill Clinton was wrong in so many other areas doesn't mean that when someone said, what time is it, Mr. President, he said 4 o'clock, that made him wrong. He can be right about some things, as difficult as it is for those of us in the religious right to admit. He can be right about some things. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. What about you? Maybe you disagree with me. Do you think the religious right would favor the war with Iraq 70% if all of the things were equal except the occupant of the White House were different, namely President Bill Clinton? Jack is calling from St. Peter's. Jack, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Thank you, Pastor Todd. It's a pleasure speaking with you. The what-if scenarios that you're kicking around about the what-if Bill Clinton was in the White House, they're interesting, but I think the American public needs to know from a reliable source such as a Missouri Synod what the Quran is teaching Muslims to think about Christians. They don't look at us very highly, and if my, what I've heard and read about the Quran is correct, these folks are going to have us in some real deep trouble in not too many years, because their beliefs are to, you know, do away with us. Is that true?
Well, I think it is. I think it is
true.
Well,
why aren't we talking about that?
Well,
that is a very important issue to talk about every day.
Well,
so
Jack, we have spent.
Understand.
We have spent, I dare say, especially in the last 2 years, hours and hours and hours, sometimes multiple hours in a row, talking about worldwide Islam, talking about Islam as a religion, talking about the situation in Muslim nations. We've talked about all of this. We have devoted an enormous amount of time, probably, maybe even more time than it warranted at certain times.
I don't think you can spend more time warning something when an entire group of people that number in the millions and millions of folks are being taught through schools and through their religion, which they believe, and I have to give them credit for that, that they believe that they want to kill the infidels. And we're the infidel.
Jack, thank you very much for the call. In fact, well, all non-Muslims are infidels. So, you know, Americans are not alone in that, although they're probably in radical Islam singled out as the greater of infidels. But all non-Muslims are ultimately infidels, according to the Quran. Now, someone once told me that the term infidel is simply synonymous with the Christian word unbeliever. Now, think about it for a second. The words mean precisely the same thing. Should I be offended when a Muslim calls me an infidel? What he's saying is, you do not believe. You are outside the faith, the true faith that is in Allah. And I would say to him, you bet I am. I'm so far outside it. In fact, the Muslim and I would probably disagree, if he's an average Muslim, about how far outside that faith I am. He'd say, you're far enough outside to be called an unbeliever, but we still have a lot in common, and maybe we even still worship the same God. And I would say, no, we don't. I'm farther outside your faith than you believe, than you suppose. We're not worshiping the same God. God and the God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and Allah are not the same God, period. There may be some historic tie via Abraham that you claim as a Muslim to that God. But the God you worship in his attributes, in his self-revelation, in particular in the incarnation of Jesus Christ in human flesh, have nothing to do with one another. But he's calling me an unbeliever, and I call him an unbeliever too. That doesn't mean I want to go and kill him. Just because they call us the infidel is not necessary. We should be glad when we're called the infidel by the Muslims, because at least they're acknowledging that there is a major difference between these two religions. In their mind, we are unfaithful. We have no faith. And that is precisely what we say of them when we say they are unbelievers. They're the same word. They shouldn't be offended when we call them unbelievers. They should be willing to say, of course we're not believers. We don't buy that Trinity stuff. We reject this Jesus Christ as the only Savior from sin stuff. Now, when the Quran says the infidel ought to be singled out for violence under certain circumstances, that's where Jack's concern comes to light. I happen to disagree, as the host of this program, that we ought to be talking about it every day. There may come a day when it needs to be talked about every day, but I think there are issues of equal concern, or even more pressing concern, to talk about. Saddam Hussein, by the way, if there's a connection between worldwide Islam and Saddam Hussein, it's very tenuous. People wonder whether or not Saddam Hussein has a tie to Islam. I mean, I'm sorry, to terrorism. I wonder whether he has a tie to Islam. He uses it as a political tool. similar in many ways to the way that our politicians use the rhetoric of Christianity to get votes to their own ends. And we sit there like dogs lapping it up. A politician says God, and we assume he's talking about Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Or he says the Almighty, and we're like, oh, it's so good to hear a politician talk about God. They are doing precisely what Saddam Hussein does with his people. When he mouths the word Allah, but I don't know if he has any connection to Islam, period. I heard once that he's got a copy of the Quran. This is from someone who's done a study of Saddam Hussein. He's got a copy of the Quran penned in his own blood. It's a multi-year project that he had done at great expense, donating his own blood as ink for the Quran. And of course, it's a handwritten Arabic version of the Quran. But look, if a politician in our country had the Bible handwritten in his own blood, it wouldn't make him a Christian, would it? Christians ought to be equally concerned when our politicians, even with the best of intentions, employ rhetoric, the rhetoric of the faith, the language of the faith, our faith, the holy Christian faith, to the ends of getting our votes. And we should not be so naive as to think that when they say Almighty or God or the big man upstairs or however they talk about it, they're talking about our God. They may be doing nothing more than Saddam Hussein is doing when he talks about Allah, simply to stir the masses in his country. Now, I'm not equating the politicians in our country morally with Saddam Hussein. I am saying they're using the same techniques. Some of them. And some of them, when they say the Almighty, do mean Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, which I wish they would just come out and say it, rather than censoring themselves, using generic terms for the God who they know full well what God they're talking about. If they want me to know as a voter or as someone listening through the media that they're talking about the true God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, then come out and say it, for heaven's sakes. Don't leave me in the dark by saying the Almighty, for which just about anybody who believes in any kind of God could say, hey, he's talking about my God. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, as promised. Here's Dr. Gene Edward Veith. The article is called Sodom Chic. It appears in World Magazine. Protest marches, campus teach-ins, flag dissing. It's like one big anti-Vietnam War reunion. On university campuses, Marxist professors, their still long hair, gray now, but pulled into a ponytail, have come out of their bunkers and have dusted off their old lecture notes about American imperialism and the warmongering effects of global capitalism. Movie stars, rock musicians, and even the loose organization of poets are condemning the war with Iraq even before there is one, and taking the opportunity to bash American civilization just like they did in the glory days of the 60s counterculture. There are many legitimate arguments against war with Iraq, writes Veith. Pragmatists worry about that invading Iraq is not necessary, that other tactics might achieve the desired results at far less cost. Isolationists believe that the United States has no business becoming entangled with the problems of these other countries. Pacifists oppose all war for any reason. These positions deserve their say, says Veith. But these arguments, though they sometimes can be heard at protests, are not what the growing anti-war movement is all about. Talk to a campus anti-war activist and you are likely to hear not disagreements about U.S. foreign policy, but anti-American hysteria. Quote, George Bush is the world's number one terrorist, for an example. Or, George Bush is worse than Saddam Hussein. Or, this is a war for oil. America needs to destroy its weapons of mass destruction. In their view, writes Veith, America, secretly controlled by multinational oil corporations, is trying to conquer the world. And for those of you Christian listeners out there, I pause here a moment to add, conspiracy theories exist on both sides. You have more in common sometimes with anti-war protesters if you're a Christian conspiracy theorist than you may believe. You both believe that the world is run by a vast conspiracy. You're both probably wrong. When asked about Saddam Hussein's record of mass murder, torture, oppression, and chemical and biological weapons, many activists just don't believe it. And that is just American, it's just American propaganda, they say. Iraq's propaganda, though, they accept as gospel truth. Many anti-war activists are more willing to believe Saddam Hussein than George Bush. Some go so far as to defend or even claim solidarity with the Islamic terrorists who attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, those symbols of American capitalism and military aggression. We now know that the Vietnam War protests were at first organized by hardcore communists and pro-communist organizations, whereupon the Peace and Love Flower Children, idealistic university students, and mainline journalists and politicians got on board the peace train. In the same manner, the recent anti-war rallies were organized by a coalition of radical socialist organizations that goes by the acronym of ANSWER, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. But they have brought on board hordes of less ideological and less extreme folks who attend their rallies for their own reasons, but who unintentionally multiply ANSWER's clout. Radicals used to put their hope in revolution. But in the post-Soviet era, the radical left has shifted to the advice of Marxist theorist Antonio Gramsci, take over the culture. This can be done by shaping the way people think, their values, and their worldviews. In this, the arts are more powerful than politics, fashion is more persuasive than arguments, and whoever can define what is cool can control the masses. And oh, I add again, oh, doesn't the church just skip right along behind it? Whoever defines what is cool, the church says, fine, that's what we'll be this week. Despite their huge impact in the 60s, leftist radicals went out of style. Ronald Reagan, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the booming stock market made them irrelevant. But now, they are trying for a comeback. What's the attraction? Why is that leftist causes can be, what is it about leftist causes that can be so fashionable? Why are the cool people in the and the cultural trendsetters, the fashionistas, the icons of popularity, why are they rallying to the cause? Veith says, we are now subject to moralizing lectures from movie stars and rock musicians, individuals not normally considered to be role models of moral rectitude. On campuses, the usual group of radicals are adopting a tone of high moral indignation in scolding America for its ethical shortcomings. Those who reject morality in their own lives often project their conscience out into a periphery of their existence. They take righteous stands on political issues and embrace idealistic ideologies as a compensation for the moral failures and guilt in their personal lives. They reject personal morality but believe in social morality. I don't think Dr. Veith has ever been more pithy, more to the point than that sentence. One of the hallmarks of postmodernism and a postmodern culture. Rejecting personal morality and believing in social morality or corporate morality. Holding the right political beliefs enables them to feel self-righteous without the trouble of actually being righteous. Conservatives as well as liberals can fall into this spiritual trap, writes Veith. This is evident among the conservative politicians who were pro-family in their voting record while committing adultery in their personal lives. Need we name names? Genuine morality, of course, has both a personal and a social dimension. Furthermore, Christians know that self-righteousness of every kind is a spiritual delusion that shuts out the need for Christ's forgiveness. That's Dr. Gene Edward Veith writing in this week's World Magazine. The article is called Sodom Chic, the Connoisseurs of Cool Reject Morality in Their Own Lives but Give Moralizing Lectures Against the United States. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I mentioned the religious right before. Would that the religious right, insofar as they are Christian, because not everyone in the religious right is Christian. I mean, I imagine someplace, somewhere, there are Mormons who fit beautifully in the religious right. They're not Christians. Jehovah's Witnesses might fit, to a certain degree, beautifully within the religious right. Orthodox Jews might be numbered among those called the religious right. Muslims, on many issues, would probably be counted among the religious right. So the religious right is not only Christian, but would that the Christians in the self-avowed religious right, would that they were concerned about the state of the church as they are about the state of the Union? About the theology that they are hearing preached as opposed to the propaganda that they are hearing from the media? Not a single syllable of propaganda from the media can pass the lips of any major outlet without people from the religious right, Christians among them, going into a war dance. But they sit in pews on Sunday morning and they hear tripe, or a mixture of tripe and truth, and they don't even bat an eye. They hold the culture to a higher standard than they hold the church. They are deeply concerned that when they turn on their television or their radio or their website at night, that they get the unvarnished truth without any spin. But when they sit in church, they are less concerned about whether or not the sermon is spinning them. Now, I can say this only because I count myself among those who are in the religious right. I think Aaron Wolf had a great point in an earlier conversation here on Issues, Etc., where he said Christians sometimes fall prey to the temptation to be news junkies and to be more concerned with the city of man than the city of God. Maybe it's because we believe we've got it all sewn up in the city of God, that we've been able to get all our facts straight, put them away safely in a lockbox, bury them in the ground like a treasure in the parable, like the guy who said, look, you're a cruel taskmaster. You've given me the talents. I'll bury it in the ground. When you come back, you'll get what's yours. Maybe we believe we've done this, and we have not seen the truth of the Christian faith as capital to be used, to be invested, to be spent. We say, okay, we've got the Christian stuff down. Now let's move on to the cultural stuff. Herman is calling from Illinois. Herman, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Regarding Dr. V's comments, if you take the anti-war revival protesters from the 60s who are out now again, and you look at from that time to now and add up that they have been often the most vocal supporters of the personal option of abortion on demand as opposed to, say, mass morality, the encouragement of things that have led to the AIDS epidemic, the sex disease deaths, drug overdoses, the drug crime underground, and you add up the deaths from that, and it far exceeds the number of people who died in Vietnam.
Thank you very much, Herman. Well-made point, as Herman always does, a well-made point. Ideas have consequences. I am the biggest news junkie I know. I can't get enough. I do it partly because I get paid to do it. It's part of the job, but I do it also because I like doing it. Even if I weren't being paid to go on the air 3 hours a day and know what's going on in the world, I'd still be doing it. People worry about Christians becoming so heavenly-minded that they're no earthly good. I don't know if that's the danger nowadays. I think maybe the danger is being so earthly-minded that they're no heavenly good. What do you think? Well, we'll talk about it again in another Open Lines.
Of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Is private confession and absolution a Roman Catholic practice? Did you know that Martin Luther called this practice a third sacrament? And how can this practice help resolve conflict in the church? You'll find answers to these questions with the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March, Confession and Forgiveness. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section, issuesetc.org. Confession and Forgiveness is written by Ted Kober of Peacemaker Ministries, a Christian reconciliation organization. The book costs $9.99 plus shipping and handling. Confession and Forgiveness, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House. That number, 1-800-325-3040.
The Bible, just a bunch of stories? Answers with Ken Ham, who's one of the designers of a creation museum near Cincinnati, Ohio. Well, surely, Ken, no Christian would think the Bible's just a collection of stories or fables, would they?
You know, honestly, few Christians would ever say that about most events in the Bible, such as Christ's birth, death, and resurrection. But when it comes to the first 11 chapters of the Bible, many Christians think they're just stories or fables, and they obviously don't see the problem this creates. You see, how do we ultimately know anything in the Bible? How do we know the babe lay in a manger? How do we know he was the Son of God? Now, there's plenty of circumstantial evidence, but you know, ultimately, the only way we know is because we accept the Word of God as written. By rejecting the 6 days of creation as written in Genesis, Christians have brought the entire Bible into question. After all, if you can use man's ideas about a very old earth to interpret the historical record of Genesis, why not also use man's ideas to reinterpret the New Testament? After all, scientists have never shown that a man can rise from the dead, so maybe the resurrection was just spiritual, not physical. Of course not. It's time that churches and Christian schools began upholding the authority of the Bible from the very first verse.
Are you aware that many Christian schools teach that dinosaurs died out millions of years before Adam? Well, for what the Bible and real science teach about dinosaurs, go to our website, AnswersRadio.com. Read Ken Ham's free booklet on dinosaurs at AnswersRadio.com.
Good afternoon, 5:31 at AM 850 KFUO. Weather for St. Louis, mostly cloudy tonight, low of about 26 for Tuesday, partly cloudy, and a high near 62, so a nice afternoon tomorrow. Right now, mostly cloudy and 34 in St. Louis. Another look at St. Louis traffic. Westbound 40 is slow, Clayton Skinker to Hanley, then slowing again west of McKnight. Southbound 270 is slow at Olive, then picking up heavy traffic from Clayton Road to Manchester. Eastbound 270 is slow at Lindbergh. Northbound 55 between Park Avenue and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow traffic in the right lane there. And eastbound 40 at Union Station, there is an accident that's cleared and traffic is still jammed back west of Jefferson. That's weather and traffic on AM 850 KFUO. More issues, etc. is next.
AM 850 KFUO invites you to join us weekly for Lenten worship. Every Wednesday at 11 a.m., we'll bring you a live broadcast of the worship service from Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church in North St. Louis County. We encourage you to make this worship hour a part of your Lenten season. Live Lenten worship every Wednesday at 11 a.m. from your friends at AM 850 KFUO, inspirational Christian radio for the world.
Welcome back. A few final thoughts before we spend the rest of the hour with Wesley Smith talking about PETA's latest ad campaign. You may have heard about it. It is daring, and we'll find out what Wesley Smith has to say in the remainder of this hour and the remainder of the program here on Issues, Etc. I was talking before about the danger of the church, and in particular of individual Christians becoming such news junkies that we lose sight of the city of God in the terms of Augustine and an earlier guest, Aaron Wolf. And I say that pointing all three of the spare fingers in my pointing hand back at myself. It is a tremendous temptation to begin to think totally in terms of, well, what's going on in Iraq? What's going on here? What's going on there? What are the issues that are facing people? The Estrada nomination, all this kind of stuff, and forget that is not why I'm here. I'm talking about a radio host, but that's not why I'm here as a Christian. That is not why God has given me breath. Those things should be of a concern. They should be a definite part of my life, but they're not the main concern. Herman had some excellent points, and I think he pointed out that this kind of dangerous thinking, when we find it among the leftists, we can see its consequences. In death, in a culture of death, we ought to be willing to see those consequences as well, even when they are among us of the religious right. Wesley Smith, senior fellow of the Discovery for the Discovery Institute. He's author of a recent column in the Weekly Standard titled "The Most Tasteless PR Campaign Ever: PETA Outdoes Itself." Wesley Smith, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well. I didn't think that PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, could outdo themselves any more than they already had. What's up now?
Hard to believe. Well, as far as I'm concerned, PETA has lost, and I hope your listeners will agree, any legitimacy as a respectable public advocacy group for the better treatment of animals. What PETA has done is they have started a pro-vegetarian campaign. Certainly nothing wrong with that. But what they have called it is Holocaust on Your Plate. And they have explicitly compared the eating of meat, the wearing of leather, to the concentration death camps, to the slaughter of 6 million Jews, and have said that those events are moral equivalents. Listen to this. This is a quote from their website called, and this is, by the way, this is a campaign that's going across the nation on college campuses. Without demonstrations, it's amazing. The final solution, PETA makes this comparison, quote, like the Jews murdered in concentration camps, animals are terrorized when they are housed in huge filthy warehouses and rounded up for shipment to slaughter. The leather sofa and handbag are the moral equivalent of the lampshades made from the skins of people killed in the death camps. They actually believe that is true. And they have pictures that juxtapose piles of dead Jews next to piles of dead pigs. To me, that's anti-Semitism. If the KKK did that, it would be called hate speech. Somehow PETA does it, and the only groups that object are groups like the Anti-Defamation League. Where are the other human rights groups? Where are the other civil rights groups? Why are only Jews complaining about this? This is horrendous.
Now, beyond someone who would simply dismiss this out of hand, saying, well, that isn't, without really thinking, that's an obvious fault, drawing a moral equivalence between the Holocaust and other Holocausts the eating of meat. What, to the person who says, now, why aren't they morally equivalent, how would you answer, Wesley?
Well, it would be a shame that one would have to compare an animal, a chicken. They have a picture comparing caged chickens to the caged people in their bunks at Auschwitz. I mean, if you need to be told how that a caged chicken is not nearly the same thing as a caged human, then I wonder about whether there's any hope for you. But if you have to be told, then what we have to assert is the sanctity and specialness of human life, that we alone among all life known in the universe have a special place and a special spot. And if we don't actually have that special place in that special spot, we'd better pretend that we do. Otherwise, instead of improving the treatment of animals, we're going to treat some people much, much worse. The fact that somebody, I mean, you talk about a self-evident truth. Only humans create. Only humans can even conceive of the concept of God, just as an example. Only humans can draw great art, create the kinds of civilizations, have language. I mean, you can go through attribute after attribute, which many in bioethics and the animal rights movement are trying to dismantle. And the idea is to say that humans are only another animal in the forest, but that's anti-human. And PETA is definitely anti-human, because if animals are the moral equal and legal and become the legal equals of people, the tremendous human harm that will cause is almost beyond quantifying.
I've got two basic concerns here. First of all, why does PETA feel the need to go this far in their ad campaigns, this kind of ludicrous comparison that they're making, and why are they getting away with it?
I have a couple of thoughts on that. First off, PETA is addicted to attention, and they don't care if it's negative attention. You know, there's an old saying in showbiz, what counts is publicity. It doesn't have to be good publicity. I think PETA goes for that, and they like to see their names in the papers. But secondly, I think they actually believe this. I've come to really accept that some members of the animal liberation community are this far twisted in their moral thinking that they actually believe it. They get away with it because, for some reason, groups on the left are held to a much lower standard than groups on the right. If a right-wing group, let's say even a pro-life group, juxtaposed, not that, of course, pro-life group wouldn't, but juxtaposed dead Jews with next to dead pigs, there'd be an outcry. if pro-life groups use very graphic, when they use graphic pictures of dead fetuses, there's an outcry. Yet here we have the opposite. They have emaciated, naked concentration camp survivors juxtaposed next to an emaciated cow. I mean, these are different. It's almost beyond description that someone could act as vile as they do and that there has really been very little outcry at all.
Why are they getting away with it? Why has there been so little?
Because they're on the left, and because a lot of people laugh off PETA. They say, oh, you know, they're the people who have naked models saying don't wear fur. And a lot of their antics are ludicrous and sometimes are even funny. But I think that the time has come to start taking these groups seriously, because PETA is not a violent group, but they have supported violent groups, for example, giving a donation to the Environmental Liberation Front, which the FBI has called the largest terrorist group in America. They have animal rights terrorists speak at their conventions. You have people such as the Animal Liberation Front that engages in terrible terror, blowing up fires, threats, assaults on people who use animals. You've got Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty Shack, SHAC, that has actually beaten with baseball bats the executives of a laboratory from England, and they fled to America to try to be able to do their business. And now these terrorists are not just assaulting the shack and threatening the shack people, but they're threatening anybody who does business with them. So you have had insurance company executives attacked, or threatened, not attacked physically yet, but threatened, pickets in front of their house and so forth, so that Huntington can't get insurance. You've had them go after auditors, and recently an auditing company just quit because they couldn't stand the pressure. You've had them going after banks so that loans have been rescinded. So if this succeeds in driving Huntington out of business, and it's becoming very close to doing that, then no business that does that works with animals can be safe from being driven out of business. If these terrorists decide to drive you out of business, they won't only attack you, they'll attack anybody who does business with you. And the tactics have included finding out the neighbors of the executives of these businesses and harassing the neighbors. So this shows you how radical and wild it gets when people believe that killing an animal is the same thing as killing a person, and wearing leather shoes is the same thing as having a lampshade made of human skin.
It seems then that you kind of painted a picture of full circle here with PETA. While they decry the violence, they would decry the violence.
They don't decry the violence. They're silent about the
right,
violence.
Right, that's what I'm saying. While they would say the violence of Auschwitz is equivalent to the violence of Tyson Foods in Arkansas, where chickens are housed en masse. But at the same time, coming full circle by supposedly increasing the rights of animals, they've actually lowered human rights, and they prove it through their support of violence against human beings.
Well, I wouldn't state that last statement quite as hard, because you can't quite pin that on them. They have supported Environmental Liberation Front. They've given defense funds to people, animal rights activists accused of crimes. They have not come out and advocated violence per se. They're very careful to try to keep a firewall up. But they have not condemned it. So we have to be accurate, because they're also lawsuit happy.
Now, tell me, I don't want any of those, and I know you don't either.
Yeah.
I'd have to ask you to defend me. but tell me about the animal rights movement in general, apart from the particular issues of PETA. Is PETA the exception rather than the rule in the animal rights movement?
You know, I used to think they were exceptional. That is, I thought that they were the wacky ones and that others were far more legitimate. But I'm not hearing the animal welfare groups speak out against this PETA campaign. One would think that if you're the Humane Society or some other animal protection organization, and PETA came out with this kind of vile, despicable moral equivalence, that you would be the first to say, wait a second, this does not represent our way of thinking. This is wrong. We disagree with it strongly, and we urge PETA to rescind this campaign. I paid real close attention to the news, and I have not yet seen one example of any, quote, mainstream animal protection group criticizing PETA for this activity, much less some of their other activities. For example, Ingrid Newkirk, who is the head of PETA, recently wrote a letter to Yasser Arafat condemning about a terrorist attack. But she wasn't upset about the killing of Jews in Israel. She was upset that a donkey was blown up in a terrorist attack. When called on that to say, how can you care more about a donkey than the people who were killed in that explosion, she sniffed, human wars are not my concern. So when these other animal groups don't criticize PETA for that kind of clear anti-human advocacy, I begin to wonder if PETA is so exceptional after all. I don't know. In fact, if some of your listeners called some local Humane Society offices, maybe you could see if they'd issue a press release condemning this procedure, this campaign.
Well, that was my next concern. For the average person who says, look, I do think that a lot of good is being done by the kind of the local animal protection agencies.
And I would quite agree with that.
Should I conclude that their silence on this issue means they support PETA in this moral equivalency between the Holocaust and eating meat?
Sometimes, you know, in law, sometimes silence, if you stay silent, you're actually making a communication. Sometimes there's a duty to speak out. Now, in this situation, I don't think there's a legal duty, but the silence is so deafening from other animal protection groups that one has to say, one comes to the conclusion that either they do not object or they're afraid of speaking out for fear that some of their financial supporters would be upset that they objected, or they don't know about it. I mean, those are the three possibilities I can think of.
Well, apparently, according to your article in the Weekly Standard, Wesley, PETA has at least a self-avowed Holocaust scholar on their side, one Charles Patterson, who's authored a book called Eternal Treblinka, and there's a quote, you say, on the website that goes as follows: during the 20th century, two of the world's modern industrialized nations, the United States and Germany, slaughtered millions of human beings and billions of other beings. Each country made its own contribution to the century's carnage. America gave the modern world the slaughterhouse. Nazi Germany gave it the gas chamber. Your reaction?
It is almost beyond comprehension. I don't know whether this fellow is a real legitimate Holocaust scholar or not. I haven't read his book, although I found out I had been sent it and had not picked it up. But that kind of equivalency is beyond belief. And you get to the place where your jaw is so stuck on the floor because your jaw drops, both not only for what is said, but by the lack of condemnation by the general community, that you begin to worry that people have lost sight of how important it is for human life to be special. You know, this is a consistent theme I bring to your show and in my work. The question before us in the 21st century is this: does human life have ultimate and incalculable meaning simply and merely because it's human? If the answer to that question is yes, then our policies will be moral, our ability to go forward with medical research will be done in a moral way, we will be a more peaceful society, we will be a society that is not racist, and so forth. If the answer to that question is no, then you have to come up with another question, which is, what is it that gives a being or an entity moral value? And in fact, in animal rights, what they are saying, generally, is if a being can experience pain, it is equal. I have gone into high schools and spoken about these issues and had very bright high school students come to me and say, you're saying that a human being has greater value than a bunny. And I will say, yes. And they will say very sincerely, with bright eyes as only the young can have, no, a bunny can feel pain. They're the equal to us. I mentioned this on a radio show, and a co-host said, my son just came home saying that our dog was our equal for the same reason. See, this is being taught to your children in the schools. PETA and people like them get to go into the schools, are brought in to talk about these issues to children without any countervailing, often without any countervailing opinions being presented, and they bring in very gruesome pictures to very young children of animals that have been butchered. And yet, if a pro-lifer brought in an eviscerated fetus, they might be put in jail. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So there's a double standard here on what is allowed in terms of advocacy between the left and those perceived to be conservative. And for some reason, the wider society will not take this animal stuff seriously, even though there's violence now associated with it, even though they have basically said that a Jew is no better than a pig or a chicken, or any human being is better than a pig or a chicken. And it's the old idea that, well, this is so ridiculous, it'll never happen here. But you know what? That's the guarantee that it could. You have to start taking it seriously and start pushing back and saying, no, human life is different and exceptional. And we're not going to create a human-animal equality. There are law firms now on major university campuses and legal clinics who have the design, they are being funded for the very purpose of permitting animals to become litigants in lawsuits, not just about animals, but the actual litigants, of course, represented by a guardian ad litem, which would be an animal rights activist. Pigs have been put in the Florida Constitution. We've talked about that on this show. The National Institute of Health, which is supposed to provide money for human medical research to benefit humans, just gave a $24 million grant to house research chimps in a retirement community that's 200 acres for 300 chimps. That's about $80,000 per chimp. That's more than my mother gets. And people just kind of laugh and giggle and say, well, it really can't happen here, or they'll say, well, yes, we want to treat animals more humanely, which of course we do. But when some of these actions are actually fronts for the idea of human-animal moral equality and legal equality, there's a real danger here to the sanctity of human life.
The more somber observer of this might say, look, I'm not going to laugh it off, but maybe PETA is doing this merely for effect. Is that the case, or do you think it is that PETA simply has lost the ability to distinguish between human rights and what they call animal rights?
I think it's both. I think that they are doing it for effect to get themselves attention. I think they reflect their funding base. You know, they are dependent on philanthropy for their millions. They get tens of millions of dollars in contributions a year. They're very powerful because they're very rich. And among the people who give them the most money are the people on the left in the entertainment industry. And they also get it from foundations. So it strikes me they must be reflecting the values of the people who fund them. Otherwise, you know, you'd stop sending them money, wouldn't you? The fact that PETA's money doesn't dry up on the vine with these kinds of activities tells you something. And that they are getting increasingly radical in their assertions and are gathering even more money, that has to tell us something, doesn't it?
Where can they go from here, Wesley? You've talked about them topping themselves or really reaching rock bottom, in my way of thinking. Can they make bolder, can they make more ludicrous assertions than they have made in this Holocaust?
I think the next one they would make is that rather than use animals in medical experiments, which they usually say don't work and aren't effective, which of course is baloney. This is not exactly, PETA is not an exactly candid and honest in its and much of its advocacy. I think that the next assertion will be, if you're going to benefit animals, you can use animals in research. If you're going to benefit people, you should use disabled people in that research. I think they're heading in that direction.
And do you think even that will dry up some of their funding?
No. I think that there are people who have so gone off the deep end, have become so anti-human, and it's mixed up with radical environmentalism and radical anti-capitalism, that I don't think that their money is going to dry up. And I think what's going to have to happen is people are going to have to say no. And I'm particularly worried not about, that whole campaign to our age. I'm assuming I'm 53 and a half, almost 54, and I'm assuming you're in your middle ages somewhere. To us, that doesn't work because we were taught right from wrong growing up. We weren't steeped in relativism growing up, and we had a better sense of history than I think the kids are getting today. This is aimed at a young audience that doesn't understand what you and I understand, Todd, and that's what's also frightening because I think PETA has a very acute sense of what works for youngsters. as opposed to what would work for us. They're not aiming at us. They know they can't get us, but they think they can get the youngsters, and that's where I think this is heading.
Beyond swaying the mind and the hearts of the culture, does PETA have any particular legislative or legal goals in mind?
Oh, sure. Their goal is to make it eventually so that you cannot, and they say so quite candidly, that we cannot use animals for any purpose. They're not. Their slogan is something like, "Their animals are not ours to eat, wear, research upon, and entertain us." And you know, they would close down all zoos, destroy all cattle ranches, etc. When the pig amendment passed in Florida, and the reason it passed is there are no pig farms in Florida to speak of. It's not exactly the pig farm state. So the animal rights groups, including the Humane Society of the United States, spent a lot of money in Florida getting voters to pay for this pig amendment that made it so that it's unconstitutional to keep pregnant pigs in gestation crates. Now, that may be a proper animal, humane treatment of animal law, but it's not proper in a constitution. And what it resulted was in the two pig farms in the entire state of Florida who used those crates, slaughtering their herds and going out of business. And when the animal rights activists were contacted, they said, good, those pigs were going to live in suffering anyway, and now these pig farms are gone, because that's their agenda.
Wesley Smith, thank you very much for your time, and keep up the good work.
Thanks, Todd.
Wesley Smith is senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, author of a recent column in the Weekly Standard titled "The Most Tasteless PR Campaign Ever, PETA Outdoes Itself." You can read this column for yourself on the internet at Wesley's website, wesleyjsmith.com. That's wesleyjsmith.com. Tomorrow on the program, the subject will be evangelism with Professor Kurt Marquardt of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We'll also talk about the church's role in reconciliation with Ted Kober, author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for March, called Confession and Forgiveness. Now, before tomorrow's program, I want you to do something. I want you to look up these passages, Revelation chapter 9, verses 14 and 15. Tomorrow we're going to bring you some sound from Pastor Irvin Baxter of End Times Magazine. I want to know if you agree with him that these passages, Revelation chapter 9, verses 14 and 15, apply directly to the war with Iraq that we're facing as a nation. Revelation 9, verses 14 and 15. We'll talk about that tomorrow on Issues, Etc. We need to beware that as we seek to protect those who are less than us, that is, the animals, that we do not drag ourselves down to the level of the animals. That's the warning here. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.